service this evening. Appreciate your faithfulness in the house of the Lord. Take our Bibles and turn to James. James chapter 5. We come to this element here that we're looking at. I just kind of want to give us a little bit of a perspective. I've gone through most of the books. We can kind of get an understanding of what is going on. And I know the great danger for me in this moment is to get a little too detailed. But we've seen that this is a book that was written to believers who are going through a great trial. They are on the run. Their entire life is a trial, right? And they're being persecuted. And he's calling for them to care about Christ-likeness. God is going to make you perfect through, if you will continue to believe and trust God, let patience have her perfect work. If you're not sure exactly how to rejoice in the midst of your trial that you're going through, call upon God. He will answer. He will help you. Ultimately, what he's going to do is he's going to stabilize your faith. You care and love him more than anything else. You won't waver. You won't be someone who's up and down and you're like, oh, I want to serve God, but don't take that away, world. You can kind of have this element of wavering. He says, you're not going to get an answer from what to do in terms of obedience. Lord doesn't answer that prayer until you're completely committed to doing his will. That's what faith is. The double-minded man is unstable in all his ways. So what God's calling for is to be able to go through the trial and rejoice is a kind of life that is completely described by a word like no longer is it about me and my will and my desire. I have given it all over to God. And I humble myself before him. I'm at his disposal. He says, let that brother of low degree rejoice. Because when you're in the trial, you can rejoice that God is going to exalt you. And the rich person over here that was living in self-dependence, you also can rejoice because your trial has turned the apple cart upside down. And now you realize, I needed the Lord. And he uses the trial bring you to that place because God's blessing is what he wants. Verse 12, blesses the man that endureth temptation, that trial. When God brings you out of it, you will receive the crown of life. So everything else that he's been dealing with this has helped us understand. We have a poor response in the midst of the trial. We want to blame God for the trial. He says, no, God does not tempt you to evil. In fact, God is not the source of evil. He's the source of only that which is good. In fact, he gives the exhibit A as your own salvation, verse 18. So what is the solution, brethren? We need to be swift to listen to God, slow to give our own opinion and assessment of things, slow to speak, and slow to get angry and frustrated about the circumstances that are around us. He says, lay apart filthiness. God has a plan. He's working to get you to that perfectness, that wanting nothing state. And in verse 21, you must lay aside and receive. You've got to be a doer of the work. And all these things are just simple, practical applications. You've got to be looking into the perfect law of liberty so that you would be blessed. This is the response. All of this is talking about one situation. I don't think it's talking about all going here and there and this, though it may in some aspect, but all of it is connected. This element. And part of what is important is your tongue. Your tongue is going to reveal what's going on inside your heart. What's coming out of my mouth is that evidence. And that's going to be important in just a moment. So we come to all this. He begins to point out things that are problems in this church. And we've seen in chapter 2, there's this element of partiality and the self-centeredness of that. How they are not walking according to God's law, which is to love your neighbor as yourself. And we saw this aspect of desiring to have a profession, but not the fruit of faith in their life, which produces works. So he argues for that and says, all right, you can talk about faith all you want to, but I want to see it at work in your life. You know, faith is pretty important. That's what chapter 1 was about. The trial of your faith. Faith is going to produce actions, how you respond. And then he comes back around, oh yeah, chapter 3, your tongue. How are we responding in this regard? So if you come to this element, chapter 3, verses 13 through 18, he begins to really screw it down here and says, okay, who is this person who has this meekness of wisdom? He says, if any man lacks wisdom, meekness is that humility that God says, this is what's going to happen. It's going to be in, it's going to be shown by how your interaction is with other people. And if you're having strife and envy and conflict and these type of things, that's not from God. Because the wisdom that's from above is first pure and gentle and peaceable. And what's interesting, he says, without partiality, that's what we saw in chapter 2. Without hypocrisy, that's what we saw in chapter 2. And so this is starting to really sum it up together. And he begins to start really driving it home in chapter 4. What's going on? Where are these divisions? Why are you having this backfire? So here, you've got Christians are in a time of difficulty, and yet they're turning on each other. And they're having squabbles and pain. You know, and that's exactly what happens. Stress comes into the marriage. And all of a sudden, now we're bickering at one another. Now, all of a sudden, stressful situation. Now the kids are getting at it. And we're getting on the, you know, just, let's say, he said, all right, where is this happening? It's coming from your own desires. Ultimately, he's going to come down to this wonderful verses 7 through 10. Submit yourselves to God. Draw nigh to Him. Cleanse your hands, you sinners. Purify your hearts, your... See that key word, double-minded, that he was talking about in chapter 1. This is what you've got to do. You've got to respond correctly to what God's doing. And he wants humility. Be afflicted. Mourn. Weep over your own sinfulness, your own pride. Humble yourself in the sight of the Lord. And that's the heartbeat of what he's been driving for, to have the right response in the trial. So, what takes place after this? He begins to pick on different manifestations that are the exact opposite of that humility is. It's speaking evil of one another with our tongues. But that's pride, that's not. Making boastful plans about tomorrow rather than consulting and submitting to God. That's pride, that's not humility. This element of, and he begins really diving into this idea of the rich man, which is someone we saw in chapter 1, that you're living apart from God, and he really comes down upon that. And in verse 7, he says, this is what the believer is supposed to be. You be patient for the Lord. Continue to endure. Grudge not against one another. All right, so here's that infighting element looking towards. But he says, be patient, suffering affliction. That brings us all the way back up here to verse 12. He says, and above all things, my brethren, swear not, neither by heaven, neither by the earth, neither by any other oath. But let your yea be yea and your nay, nay, lest you fall into unbelief. So, we have to kind of answer this. I think the first element here is, what's the relationship of these words to the point of the Lord? Now, this element of above all things, that has two different ideas. It can mean one or two things. You kind of have to, I don't know, you discern for yourself which one you believe is going on in this passage. Could be saying, this is the most important thing. You look at it and say, really? But I think there's something that's a little bit, there is something here, what's going on here, that I think I'm going to try to justify that type of interpretation. On the other aspect, he might be saying along this as being, on top of this, in addition to what I've just said, make sure that this is a priority as well. So there's two different ways that word can have it. It's just a slight different nuance. But no matter what it is important, and he's bringing this back around. And I want to highlight the aspect that here it is. It seems like it pops out at the most unexpected times. But he just comes out of nowhere and says, oh yeah, watch your tongue. Oh yeah. And it just kind of hits you in chapter 1, verse 26, and hits you in chapter 3, and it's multiple aspects of speaking evil of one another. It seems like every time he turns the conversation in terms of a way that might be unexpected, in terms of, oh yeah, I'm tracking, it's like, boom, the tongue pops out. How does this have anything to do with anything? What's my tongue got to do with it, all right? You're like, that is the evidence. What we have here, I don't know. Have you ever heard these words before? above all things, my brethren, swear not, either by heaven, neither by earth, neither by any other oath, but your yea be yea, and your nay be nay. That be another other place in Scripture. All right, yeah, the Sermon on the Mount. These are the words of Jesus. I haven't necessarily made it a big point, because I feel like I just want us to understand, but the book of James draws on the Sermon on the Mount more than any other book in the New Testament. It's really amazing. But this is one of those clear aspects where it's like almost word for word, pulling it from the teaching of Jesus. And so, when we think about what is the issue that's going on, some people have looked at this meaning that you're not supposed to make any oath. And so there are those that are Quakers today that would say, get in the court, they say, I have a religious conviction against putting my hand on the Bible and taking an oath. They take this as a sweeping command across everything. And when you look at it, you say, well, it's pretty just, so swear not. But in terms of everything in the Bible has to be laid right alongside of other things. And God gave legislation in the Old Testament about taking oaths. The Old Testament saints were required to take oaths. Abraham, Jacob, Joseph, Jonathan. Jesus took an oath while he was under trial. Paul makes certain statements calling upon God and Christ as witnesses of his truthfulness. And God himself took an oath. Hebrews chapter 6, verse 16. There are some element of saying, you put all this stuff on one side and say, that doesn't seem to be exactly what he's going for. They're kind of missing the boat in regards, almost like when God says, do not kill, they say, well, that means don't go to war or don't be a part of that. Well, there are aspects of context that say, no, that's not exactly. So what's he going on for in this passage? When he says, swear not either by heaven or earth. Well, in their society, and we see this from Matthew 23, they were very, very studious about what was a lie. So if I tell you something and I swear by the temple, now let me make sure, but it says, if you swear by the altar, it's nothing. No, I didn't have to keep that one. I swore by the altar. But if you swear by the gift on the altar, oh, you better keep that promise. You're like, what? That was going on, and they have all kinds of examples in terms of, you probably remember those. If you swear by the temple, you're okay, but if you swear by the gold on it, it gets kind of silly, doesn't it? And Jesus is saying, you don't need to swear, because what happens is, our society, every relationship is built on, can I trust you? Are you a truthful person? And oftentimes when you have multiple interactions with people, because that's what happens, we have relationships, and my word falls down, we have to start doing things to bolster that word. And what they would do is, you say, I'm going to really show you, I pinky swear. Little kids do things like that. I'm really serious this time. But there's aspect of, do we need extra things to verify our words? We shouldn't. How many times, I mean, think about yourself. I mean, I don't know if everybody lies and things, but if they'll say, honestly. Well, thank you. Thanks for including that word so I know. Yeah, if I was to be honest with you, you know, we put certain, or no, seriously. You know, and I know there's aspects of teasing and things like that, but there's an element that if we have to fortify our words so that people believe us, we are not truthful. And there's an element to, I find it very fascinating. I've always wondered about this because I've studied the book of Leviticus. And the very last chapter of Leviticus is about vows. You make a vow and you pay it. I'm thinking, I really believe Leviticus is a deep, theological book with lots of symbolism, lots of beautiful things. You come to this element and say, why would it end? It's kind of a head scratcher, maybe to some degree. But there's an element that says, if you're going to walk with God, you must be a person that what you see is what you get. And I'm not trying here to put on a facade. I'm not trying to deceive people. I'm not trying to get people to think a certain way about me. But I'm an honest, truthful person. And when the word is yes, it's yes. Everybody knows it's yes. And they don't have to give up. And if there's no, it's no. So this is an element that I think, say, why do we lie? Why do we deceive? Well, oftentimes it's to protect ourselves. I always think about it, it's really struck me as I mentioned multiple times, but it feels like it's a novel thought in the last year or so for me, to realize that lying is always the second sin. If there wasn't something to cover up, I wouldn't have to lie. And so you say, well, why does God get so worried about lies? Because lies is the masking of everything else that's ugly. It's the, I don't know if you've used the wrong illustration, but it's the cloth that covers the dead body. Okay? Well, you can't see what's underneath it. Another aspect of why we lie is to magnify ourselves. Make ourselves a victim. Better. And that kind of goes back to a sneaky serpent type sin. Wicked five letter words we call the start of the thing. Right. There really is this aspect of we come to exaggeration. Misrepresentations, false impressions. God says, if you're going to walk with me, your tongue must demonstrate humility, walks in truth, pride, walks in peace. So these things, I think, are really do come and say, oh boy, that really does, the axe sure strikes close to the root of the tree when it comes to. God's not looking for a religious show. Any man seem to be religious, I don't know. See that we can walk along and show. Think that we're a whole lot closer to God than we really are. A tongue. God help us to do that. We don't fall into this element of condemnation, where we stand before God ashamed. We do not walk. And God help us to bless us. All right. Go ahead and